So.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk.
I'm not sure that was the most beautiful Tarua shofar sound in the history of Tarua shofars, but well,
I like it.
It is the best we could do under the circumstances. Happy to, I am glad that Yahweh has a sense of humor. We are really fortunate that our God, our boss, our creator, Dad, our father is has a sense of humor. And is appreciative of his children, even when we may not be fully capable and live up to the full expectation. But I know he has a good time and he likes to party. And so we did blow a shofar, not once but twice. Happy Tarua to one and all. It may not be sunset on the West Coast for you, Kirk. Got to be close there.
Very
in
close.
Texas. Yeah, for you, JB, Leia, and
no,
I.
We were. Trying to teach Delin how to blow the shofar earlier. She's learning to purse her lips just right.
That's good.
Oh, that's good. Cute. Yeah, we had dinner at our favorite little close by restaurant. We live as part of this little community. We kind of go from a bubble, which is where the boat is in the marina, which is a really a nice bubble, to this bubble of this home community, which is part of a resort here on the island. And there's a restaurant that there's only three of us at the restaurant. So that's how, you know, the COVID world, that, you know, that things don't get much attention. And it sits on the most beautiful, beautiful palm-lined white sand beach overlooking the perfect turquoise blue Caribbean with the rest of the island in the background and perfectly set up so that you see the sunset through the palm trees. And there we are, you know, just the two of us having this restaurant to ourselves, having Tarua dinner. It's kind of become, in fact, Kirk, we sent you pictures last
yes,
week.
Yes, you did.
I mean,
look wonderful.
Yeah, we're trying to develop some routines and pre-show having dinner there. And we know the cook real well at the restaurant, the chef. So it's become a nice Tarua and Shabbat routine for us. Kirk, you wrote me, hi JB, also,
and
Kirk,
JB.
You wrote me a note, an email saying that you mm-hmm. thought it would be good to cover Yeshaya 18. We've been dialing up a remarkable end times prophecy in Yeshaya 29, and it's gripping all the way through, and we'll return to that, but Tarua is about a fall harvest, and Yeshaya 18 speaks about that harvest, actually presents the timing of that harvest. And so I would like to agree with Kirk and share it. I have always gone into Tarua with a mea culpa. Have any of you guys seen our listeners seen the movie Groundhog Day?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, Bill Murray, the movie Groundhog Day. And he wakes up and every day is Groundhog Day, and you know, every day of his life, and he's kind of wondering what's happened. Well, for me, Tarua is every day of my life. I woke up and it's Tarua, and I will wake up tomorrow, and it will be Tarua. And yesterday was also Tarua. So, you know, I look at Tarua as it's 365 days a year. I've been, you know, reasonably dedicated to this for the last 20 years. I've probably averaged 8 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, translating and sharing what I've learned for 20 years. But something happened, I guess it was probably now 2 to 3 years ago, when we started reading prophecies that appeared like there's just no way this is talking about anybody else but us and what we're doing. And we realized that back 2,500, 2,700 years ago was talking about what we are doing for him and the family. And that just so fundamentally changed for a lot of us, our view of not only this program, but of the books and the writing. And we felt it's not a burden, but it is a sense of responsibility that, I can't speak for anybody else because you know, everybody has a life they need to live. But my life became all consumed, pretty much all consumed when you're doing, you know, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. But it is literally all consumed by this because I began to look at, well, you know, how puny is the little time that I have left, my life compared to this is something Yahweh wants and is really going to talk about prophetically. And he's not talking about it prophetically because we're somehow important, because we're not. I mean, fact is, we got the job by default. Nobody else wanted it.
Understood.
That is the qualifications. Nobody else wanted it. When asked, we said, sure. Why not?
Sure.
Sounds like
willingness.
Willingness. Yeah, it was willingness. That was pretty much it. I do think we bring some meaningful attributes to the table. You know, it's like God typically tries to work with people who do bring attributes that he likes to work with, but you know, essentially you're a tool and he's supplying all that you need. But once that happened, you realize, boy, he just happens to be God. He made this promise, and he really wants to keep it.
Yeah.
The people he made it to are acting like little shits. I mean, they are. Yeah. They're so daggone stubborn. They're so full of themselves. They're so religious. They're so misguided. They're just being brats. But God still says, you know, but I made the promise, and they're my people. Best prescription is I'm going to have a Gentile, a goy, translate my message, the prophets and the Torah, to them and explain it to them, because I made a promise and I'm hoping that they accept. And there's going to be a number that accept. We just don't know how many. And that is what we're doing. That is.
Mm-hmm.
That is our life. We're devoted to this. And if there's any hint of this is a sacrifice, please throw that idea away. This is the coolest job in the history of jobs. It's the most fun, the most rewarding thing in the history of ideas. It to be on the front lines of this opportunity is just marvelous.
Amazing.
And particularly when you realize that we don't have we're not bringing anything to the party other than a willingness. And so it's all the opportunity without the responsibility, if you will. So here we are on Tarua. And I want to project Teruah in a way that's meaningful for our listeners, because Teruah should be a special day for everyone who is part of the covenant family. You know,
certainly.
Our favorite day of the year clearly is Pesach. It's everybody's favorite. And to integrate matzah into Pesach and understand the meaning of walking through the doorway of life and the sacrifice of the lamb, and how we're nourished by it, and how God wants this wonderful party with all of these symbols, with this promise that we would not only love but be loved and live forever, but that we are also being perfected, the fungus of religion and politics removed from us, because it's a joint celebration with unyeasted bread, and how that is all part of us becoming Bokodom, firstborn children, so that we're not just immortal, we're God's kids. We're not just part of his family, we're perfected. And so it's this marvelous celebration at the beginning of each year. And of course, that leads 7-7 later to the promise of the Shabbat, to the promise of seven and Shabuah, where Yahweh says, with my family, the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, and Lakotam, I'm going to enrich you. I'm going to empower you. I'm going to enlighten you. I'm going to take you from where you are as a mortal being stuck in three dimensions. I'm going to take you to seven dimensions. I'm going to teach you everything you ever needed to know. Speaking of that, I had reason in a chapter that I was writing on Eden to translate Yeshayah 51. And you might say, okay, you do a lot of crazy things, but how'd you get to Isaiah 51 when you're translating Bereshit chapter 2? Now, they're just a little bit apart. Well, remember how many times I have said that I think that the feasts represent time itself, and that we walk through this doorway of life called Pesach into Yahweh's home, across this perfecting threshold of matzah, get adopted in his family and get enriched and empowered on Teruah. We share this this message along with the running to the world, so that Yahweh's family can be reconciled with him, and then we get to camp out Sukkah with our Heavenly Father for all time. Well, the story of camping out with God is the Garden of Eden. That's camping out with God.
Oh, yeah.
And so what I've said is all this time that these seven annual feasts represent the 7,000 years of human existence from the garden to the end of the earth as we know it. And that last 1,000 years is a celebration of the Shabbat and of Sukkah, where not only do we camp out with God, but God is restoring the entire earth to the conditions found in Eden. Guess what Yeshayah 29 says? Oh, 51. God says, I'm restoring the earth to the conditions that were experienced at Eden. So that is where we're headed, and we're headed there in a hurry. You know, it's now the late summer of 2020. This is going to happen in 2033. We're only 13 years away from celebrating the earth being restored to the conditions at Eden. And that's not just a beautiful environment. An environment without religion, without politics, without military, without conspiracy, without idiocy and annoyance and all of that sort of thing. And so it's a marvelous promise that God has made to us, and that is where we're going. So by celebrating Teruah, we're recognizing that it is the fifth of seven Moed Mikra that are going to be celebrated and fulfilled, that it's going to be fulfilled between now and year 6000 Yah, which is 2033, that this prophecy we're going to present seems to have it after Israel is thinned at the waist, and before the massive the flood of Islamic jihadists into Israel. That seems to be the timing, and my my guess is that that timing is sometime. Are 7 years away from it. Could be 2028. I think it has to happen before 2029 is the timing of this. So let's begin the prophecy. The first part, we'll go through that.
You're cutting out. Off.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can email him. Hopefully he can call back in this time.
Yeah, I'm sending him a little. I'm sending him a quick email. Hopefully he.
All right.
Send
him a message. To the chat.
Yeah,
all I told him. Paying attention to that.
Yeah.
VCR has been on a kick lately, ain't it?
They're very disappointing. Gosh. Are we live?
They can hear us.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay, they can hear us. So then somebody else can also, they can send the people that know his email, they can send him an email as well, and maybe, yeah. But I'm sure he's aware of it. He's probably trying to see where he can get it.
Yeah, I've just called in on my cell phone.
Okay.
Are you able to hear me from my cell phone?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm good now. Everybody else can hear it.
All right. The Direct Connect didn't work. We have no idea why it dropped me a second time, but we'll try it via cell phone. It seems to be working at this point. Let's get into the prophecy. Guys, carry on. If I'm cut off again, we'll do the best we can. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among the cities, from the inhabited cities. Of course, one of the things that's just so fascinating about this is you go back in time. Where was the wannabe Apostle Paul headed when he had his so-called conversion experience?
He launched everything from Damascus. It's a horrible
place.
And
yeah, where was he taken when he was struck lame and blind?
Damascus. Inside Damascus to take somebody to
heaven. Where did the voice that talked to him, which was obviously Satan, did the voice that talked to him tell him to go? Damascus.
Once again. Yeah.
Right. What does Yahweh say about Damascus? Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. Where did Yahweh tell Dode to go? Jerusalem. Where did tell Abraham to go? Mount Moriah in the middle of Jerusalem.
Go up to the hill.
Right.
Yeah. Even told Lord.
Where is Yahweh returning?
Yeah,
Jerusalem.
Going to Jerusalem.
If you want to identify with God, you want to spend time with God, there's only one city. And it sure as hell isn't Damascus. It's Jerusalem. It's always been Jerusalem. It will never be anything other than Jerusalem. Anyway, then you go fast forward to the horrid period of the Roman abuse of Israel. And there were three times the Romans attacked Israel. But guess where the legions were pulled?
They were always Damascus,
Syria.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then when Hadrian finished with his barbarian act and went off with his little boy toy to play Mysteries of Dionysus in Greece and be a little pervert, when he went off and did that, guess who he put in control of the province that had been once known as Yehuda?
Damascus.
And it was out of Damascus that the first revolt took place. The Jews don't like to talk much about the first Roman conquest and revolt because they brought it on themselves. They had two boys and a mommy that were vying over who was going to be chief priest and who was going to be king. And the chief priest job paid better than the king job. So the boy that got the king wanted the chief priest job, and they went back and forth and tried to bribe various armies to support their cause. And finally, the Romans said enough with this crap, and the Romans came in and cleaned their clock. That was the first Roman revolt. Of course, the second that they suppressed the troops also came out of Damascus. Yeah, and that was in 70, and then again in 133. When Akiba came up with this false messiah. One of the most stunning things in the world, if you're listening and you are a Jew, you're obviously not a religious Jew or you wouldn't be listening, but if you are a secular Jew, you got to wonder how in the world your people came to believe a religion whose founding father was responsible for the diaspora. He promoted a false messiah, Bar Kokhba, and brought Roman wrath upon Judea for the third time in about 100 years, and had the land salted, hundreds of thousands of Jews crucified, the rest hauled off as slaves into Europe, beginning the diaspora and the complete destruction of Jerusalem. And that's the guy that you make the father of your religion. Got to be insane. Anyway, Damascus. She shall actually become a twisted and tangled heap of falling buildings and rubble. If you look at the outskirts of Damascus with all of the jihad activity and the Syrian and Russian-backed bombings, it is – Google it sometime. It is exactly that. It is a tangled heap of falling buildings and twisted rubble. And the reason it's twisted rubble – is because once upon a time, if you had a stone building, or even when the Romans didn't even invent concrete, because concrete existed long before Rome. But when you built out of concrete, before there was rebar, it just crumbled and fell to the side, and that was it. You could never have – concrete doesn't twist. Does a lot of things, but doesn't twist. And, you know, in the Arab world where you make things out of clay blocks, doesn't twist. But rebar – twist. So when they blow up these buildings, you get this heap of twisted rubble. So that's
and you used a wall, you know.
Yeah. Yes, you got 17:1. I think I mentioned 18 earlier. I apologize. It is 17:1 that we're talking about here. It is also interesting that Yah was predicting the complete and utter destruction of Damascus, which is prophetic because guess which city has the longest continuous inhabitants?
Damascus.
Yep, the longest continuously inhabited city in the world. And so for Yahweh to bring a prophecy and say, oh, by the way, Damascus is going to become a twisted heap of ruins, that means, A, it's in the future, and B, there's a that series of events is going to launch something profound pertinent to Israel. Because Yahweh doesn't care to what happens in Beijing. It means nothing to him. He does not care what happens in Tokyo. He does not care what happens in Los Angeles or in Northern California with 1,000 fires that they want to blame on everybody else. I was told that Trump the other day was a climate arsonist, so they're Trump's fault. I didn't know that Trump was a plague with lightning. I guess they're going to call him, what's the god of lightning, Thor or whatever it is? Maybe not. Maybe it's another one. Thor maybe is the one with a hammer. I can't keep them straight. But They call them a climate arsonist. I thought that and I was really convinced that those fires started by lightning strikes, but, you know, what do I know? Truth doesn't matter. Hey, I had dinner the other night with my best friend on the island, and, you know, he tells me, you know, don't bring up politics. My wife is really crazy liberal. And so we thought, and I talked to Leigh, I said, no politics. Because Leigh and I are anti-politics. We can usually talk politics with anybody because all we have to do is to be opposed to what they're opposed to, and we can easily do that. We get along just fine. We're opposed to both sides. That works out really good. We thought we were talking about sports, and we were talking about the NBA and the NFL and how so many viewers are upset that they've taken something that was a diversion from reality and made it all about politics. You know, there's Black Lives Matter here, there, everywhere. They're wearing it on their shirts, on their caps, on the back of their jerseys, put it on the field, put it on the court, doing commercials on it, doing special commissioner coming out and talking about it. And all of a sudden you just want to puke because, you know, Black Lives Matter is the most hypocritical organization in the world today. And it just makes you sick. So we said, you know, oh my God, you can't even watch sports anymore. And then she went into this this tirade and say, how could you say that about Black Lives Matter? So it's, well, it's simply the most hypocritical organization in the world today. You know, the fact of the matter is that if a black man is murdered, and they are at a disproportional rate, 93% of the time it's another black person. And so if Black Lives Matter, and they do, don't be pointing your finger at anyone other than your own community, because at 13% of the population, you're responsible for 93% of the murders. So you have a serious problem, and it is your problem in the community. Stop blaming other people. And, oh, my goodness, you said, you know, that's not what they think. And I said, because they don't know the facts. I said, well, what difference do the facts make? That's not what they're about. And I said, well, there are only evidence and reason. I said, I understand in the new liberal world, the new liberal mindset, because facts don't suit your agenda, that you don't like facts and you don't use reason. She says, no, it has nothing to do with facts and reason. Facts are meaningless, and it's about what people actually project and what they believe. I don't think I even know how to respond to that. And my introvert wife here, she comes out with let's talk about recipe books.
Good call. Good move. I believe you can fly. You going to go jump off a bridge?
Oh, yes.
I believe you can fly. Yeah. Go jump off that bridge.
Facts.
Yes.
Facts.
You know, it's like, well, why would you have courts and justice? She owns a restaurant. She says, so why do you bother with a menu? Why do you bother with pricing? You should give people whatever you think they should eat and charge them whatever you think is fair or not fair. What does it matter? You know, I don't know. Pay your suppliers of your food or don't pay them. What does it matter? What is it with the invoice? Pay your rent, don't pay your rent. See if I care. I mean, none of it matters. Abandon and forsake. Yeah, I mean, listen. Without facts, you can't reason. Without reason, you can't think. If you can't think, you are nothing more than just a blob. You know, hello, yeah. Blob. How are you, blob? Well, I would know, but I really don't know because I don't know.
It moves us back to Neanderthal man. He didn't have the ability.
Well,
he didn't have an osama.
That's
the point of having an
osama? That's pejorative of Neanderthal. Now, won't you be knocking Neanderthal like that?
I'm sorry.
I'm
politically incorrect. I'm so sorry.
That's racist. That is inappropriate. Neanderthal lives matter. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, abandoned and forsaken.
Neanderthals didn't have time for thinking and feelings. They were reliant
on just
facts.
Bludgeoned.
You know, the funny thing
fact,
is
that animal will kill me.
Neanderthals had bigger brains and were clearly more artistic, had better homes, had invented more tools than had Homo sapiens. The kind of Homo, I think they probably are in the line of Homo sapien, but Homo sapien, I think, is what we are officially designated at, and Neanderthal is part of that line. But Neanderthal was smarter. It's it's a freak of nature that Neanderthals didn't prevail, although it appears that we may all have a little Neanderthal in us, but we like to kid about them, but they were the brightest of the humans at the time. Be that as it may. Abandoned and forsaken. Don't you be knocking my Neanderthals, though. I think they were cute.
No, not anymore. Abandoned. I stand corrected.
Yeah, it's, I'll defend the platypus to the last. Abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of Aeor, which means reputed outcasts. So if God is talking about a place that is an unusual name like Aeor, you need to translate it, not just transliterate it. And the translation of it is land of exiles, repudiated outcasts. Well, the most repudiated outcasts and refugees today are the Fakistinians, known to the world as the mythical people known as the Palestinians, people who, well, there is no such ethnic group and there is no such country, and yet the world is trying to carve a country for the fake people out of the land that God actually gave to his people, who are called Yehudim, Jews. Nonetheless, God is saying, abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of Aeor. There was an area called the Arnon Valley in Ammon, which is Jordan, of renounced and destitute people, and they are actually the majority now of the people of the Jordan, and they are these people who are considering themselves to be outcasts and exiles called Fakistinians. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias along with their helpers. This is Adar. I love this term because if you study the Quran and the Hadith, as I would recommend no one does, but I did spend three or four years of my life doing because this voice who identified himself as God said, I want you to do this. And I came up with three really good excuses as to why I shouldn't have to do this. And he outsmarted me. So I ended up doing it, and what I found is that that Muhammad was an absolute abject failure in Mecca because the Meccans knew him, and they had played him for a fool, and they said, you know, all you want is sex, power, and money. So you just stop badgering us and playing this your pretend god game. We'll give you sex, power, and money. You just acknowledge our god. So he says Alat, Aluza, and Manat are goddesses along with Allah. And we'll acknowledge the goddesses of the Kaaba. And everything was fine. They plied him with women and power and money. But then the daddy of the six-year-old girl that he was sexually abusing, who was his lone devotee, said, wait a minute, you were telling us that you were speaking for the god of a monotheistic religion, and now you have four gods. This does not compute. I'm going to take my daughter away from you unless you correct that. And so Muhammad said that all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan. The only time Muhammad actually told the truth, that and when he admitted that he was demon-possessed. And he renounced that, and he was run out of Mecca in shame. Because that was on the way out, he told us that he had flown on a winged ass to Jerusalem to meet with all of the Jewish bigwigs in the temple. Of course, the credibility of that story isn't the fact that asses don't have wings, because I'm sure that, you know, unicorns poop rainbows and that asses really do have wings. So I'm sure he was right on that part. But guess what? There was no temple in Jerusalem. It had been destroyed a scant 600 years.
600.
Muhammad was too stupid to know that. And of course, the most amazing part of the story is that the only way you can get to the Islamic heaven is through hell, because he and the flying ass jumped off the dome out of the Dome of the Hoofy Print into the sky, and they went through hell and en route to the Islamic heaven. and the Islamic hell was filled with women, no men there, and the women were all being hung by their breasts, and he asked why, and of course it's because they didn't cherish their husbands sufficiently.
What a piece of work.
Yeah, pretty piece of work, Muhammad was. So Muhammad, you know, runs to Medina, which is called Yathrib at the time. Yathrib, it's filled
Clue.
With Jews. 75% of the community is Jewish. That's where he came from. His mother was Jewish. His father was likely Jewish, too. And he, when he gets there, the Jews had failed to accept him as their Messiah. And so he tells the answer that his God has promised virgins in paradise and that if they will kill for him and be robber barons, you know, basically Kublai Khan, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane kind of thing, that if they'll kill for him, they get to keep 80% of what they steal. And if they get killed killing for him, that they get 70 virgins in paradise. And so that was the quite the deal. He says, oh, by the way, you get to, in my religion, you get to rape as many women as you want, and pedophilia is just fine. Thievery is good. Killing is good. All good under the hood.
Lying.
And so the people that he convinced that he was representing God and that God wanted them to become mass murderers and terrorists and thieves and pedophiles and rapists were called the helpers. They were called the answer. That is what this is saying. So God is saying that these roaming animals that are acting like militant militias, they're the helpers. Well, that is the entirety of Muslims. They would consider themselves the answer, the helpers. It's just God likes to tease us with these insights. If you pay attention, you know what he's talking about. But they will cease and prostrate themselves because there will be no one left to terrorize. Well, which religion is known best for prostrating themselves?
Five times a day.
That would be Islam.
Five times a day.
And because there will be no one left to terrorize, what religion is most equated with terrorism?
Islam.
Yeah, and by the way, these Pakistanians in Jordan, what religion are they?
They are Islamic.
Yes, and about Damascus, it's going to be a twisted heap of ruins. It's a twisted heap of ruins because what religion is fighting amongst brothers shall raise their hand against their brother?
Yeah, Islam against Islam.
Just think about the prostration thing. I mean, what God would create an inferior being to bow down and worship him? How sadistic would your God have to be to do that?
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sadistic.
Yeah. And
pretty insecure.
And then the idea that God, really what God did is, I designed you, so I want your, when we're together, I want your nose in the dirt and I want your ass up facing me. Please moon me 15 times a day. That would be my idea of a really good thing. That's how I designed you. I want to look at you that way. You know, I just don't think so. What kind of a God would say, you know, nothing beats terror when it comes to forming
having a good time,
meaningful relationships. So would you please terrorize for me? Well, finally, what they're going to do is they're going to find out there's no one left to terrorize. They will wipe each other out. Then it says, so the fortified city will cease to exist. That would mean Damascus, which is heavily fortified, by the way, will cease to exist because of Ephraim, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Aram, Syria, being similarly and vehemently, vehement and burdensome. Ephraim, of course, is a synonym for the 10 of the 12 tribes. Northern Kingdom.
Yeah.
Essentially what we would refer to as Israel. And because of Israel, God's saying that Damascus will be no more. But he's going beyond that. He's not just saying that the longest continuously inhabited city in the world will be no more. He's saying, and not just a heap of ruins. It's no more. He is also saying that the government of Syria is going to fall with it. I mean, God's not shy when it comes to landing on the line. So the government of Syria, out of Syria, is not going to stand anymore. And including the remnant of Aram Syria, were being similarly vehement and burdensome. The children of Yisrael shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Well, what's amazing about all this is that last time I checked, there's 1.5 billion Muslims. And in Israel, there's, what, about 7 million Jews?
Yeah.
If there's a significant magnitude of difference between 7 million living in a country the size of a postage stamp and 1.5 billion. And yet, the Muslims are armed to the teeth and all committed to the destruction of Israel. Now, there have been a couple of peace treaties. You know, if it had been anyone other than Trump, he would have been hailed as the architect of the greatest achievements in modern history in terms of peace. To get two Islamic countries to sign peace treaties with Israel, and these are peace treaties with almost no pre-existing conditions, normalizing relationships with Israel, and there'll soon be a third and a fourth. But because the liberal media is epileptic when it comes to Trump, I mean, it's just like they go into meltdown mode. It's almost comical. They want the Nobel Prize rescinded because Trump was nominated. I mean, the guy should get the crown of crowns based upon what he's done. I'm stunned by the whole thing. Of course, it's not going to work. Muslims are going to be Muslims. They're going to destroy Damascus. They're going to wipe each other out in Jordan. And then they're going to come into Israel. I mean, that's what they are going to do. But it is interesting that we've had this episode. It was like when the Russians decided to help Syria.
Yeah.
And the Russians had to help Syria, not because of Syria. I don't think they cared at all about Syria. But the Russians care a lot about Iran because of the pipelines that they have built and the natural gas and the like that they feed to Europe there. And so and we have so badgered Russia that she has to do business with Iran, that the Russians, had they not come in on behalf of Damascus and Assad, Syria would have already
fallen too soon.
Way, and we would have had this occur 6 or 7 years in advance of the appropriate timing. So I think these peace treaties, just like the Russians coming in on behalf of the Syrians, and then the Turks going against the Kurds, who would have taken the regime out. I mean, they were effective fighters. But that all has to – all it gets to play out on the timeline that Yahweh had announced. And so I think these peace treaties are buffering agents.
Mm-hmm.
The children of Yisrael, and it could be a little bit more than that. You know, Yahweh was forgiving. You know, if they're going to be Muslims and Arabs that relinquish their desire to destroy Israel, you know, they'll get the benefit of having their souls eliminated at the end of their mortal lives rather than an express ticket to Sheol. One's a whole lot better than the other. So, you know, I'd highly recommend it on behalf of Israel's enemies.
Yeah.
And, oh, by the way, the royalty in most of those countries
are Jews.
They happen to. Yeah, they're ethnically Jews. The children of Israel shall continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, which is stunning when you consider this was written 770 BCE.
27 years ago.
You'd be hard-pressed to find any nation that was clearly a nation. There's no question Israel was a nation, as was Yehuda at the time of this writing, that still exists today. I mean, it's just unfathomable that this would be true. And with the world all against them, with the Holocaust and all the conspiracy theories and everything else, they still exist. That's a bold statement. The children of Israel shall continue to exist. It's against all odds, all sense of reason. So we move on to Yeshayah, Isaiah 17:4. And it shall actually come to pass in that day that the size of Yaakov, that's Israel, shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. The fattest, best protected, and most important place of his body shall be leaned, made thin and shrink in size. Well, this is, again, really specific. This is saying that if you were to take Israel from north to south, you go to its waist, which would be in the middle, and God's saying that that middle part of Israel is going to shrink in size such that the country becomes unsustainable, too vulnerable to its enemies. So this will be like Neville Chamberlain giving the high ground of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler to get peace in our time and start World War II. And God is saying in advance, 2,700 years ago, that Israel is going to be shrunk at the waist and no longer be viable and sustainable as a nation. And if you look at all of the world's two-state solutions, Israel becomes less than 10 miles wide at her midsection, at the waist, where 70% of the people live. And she is no longer viable as a nation. So God's put it out that that is what's going to happen. And there is nothing we can do to stop it. Just be aware that it's going to happen so that you're, I mean, that's the part of prophecy that's important. That's why when we read so many prophecies about what we're doing, you don't run from them. You don't cover them up. You expose them because God wants us to know about them, because the best way he has to accomplish two tasks is to lay it out and say, this is what's going to happen, because when we're aware of what he said and we see it happen, it validates that he inspired this and that we can trust him. And the second thing is he's telling us this so that when it happens, we're not surprised, and that we have made decisions that are reasoned because we know in advance what's going to occur. So he's trying to take care of his children through these prophecies. So if we were to move to our next statement, which is Yeshayah 17:5, it reads, then it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest. So there we are, Teruah. So we're going to expect the world to narrow Israel at the waist. So there's going to be an agreement that will be brokered, a two-state solution kind of an agreement, peace in our time kind of an agreement, that will narrow Israel at the waist, which will give the Muslims and the Fakistinians all of Gaza, which they've already given, most of the West Bank, and there will be the celebration that we have achieved peace by having made Israel insanely vulnerable, and the Muslims were going to attack immediately thereafter. But right after that occurs, and before they flood into Israel, after Damascus has fallen, this harvest is going to occur. This is Teruah. Be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest, the reaping of fruit from the chaff, in the proper season. It's from Katsar and Katsir, to snatch away and to cut away the branch so as to remove it from for a short period of time. But that time that it's being removed is a vexing time of grief, which must be shortened due to the extent of the provocation and uncontrollable anger of the divisive anguish and devastating rage. That's pretty well described in terms of timing. So it's you don't need a revelation or any anything else to know that there is a harvest. That this harvest is going to be timed after the destruction of Damascus and the fall of the Syrian government, and immediately after Israel is thinned at the waist with some kind of a peace treaty that gives trades Israeli land for promises of peace that's brokered by the world that gives up enormous swaths of the West Bank that makes Israel suddenly thinner. So it's a harvest of standing grain. You know, Yahweh wants us to be upright. Those that are with him are not bowed down. They are upright. Mm-hmm. So in comparison to the terrorists who are prostrating themselves, this is standing grain. By the way, it's kind of an interesting thing. I was had a reason to, I think it was because of the prophecy and Yeshaya 51 about Eden, that it was, it specifically mentions in conjunction with Eden and with Yahweh's tell us where our focus should be. And it talks about Abraham and Sarah, and that Abraham is our father, Sarah is our mother. And that Yahweh then introduced his hand as part of that equation, grasping hold. I said, you know, have you ever just looked at Yahweh's name of the of the two people that are standing up, the two hays, and in the middle, that the wa looks like it could easily be a young Yishak reaching up and standing between Sarah and Abraham. And so I just presented in Hebrew the two hays with the wa in the middle and said, boy, that looks like family.
Yeah.
And then to get to Yahweh's name, he's adding his hand.
Yeah, JB pointed that out a while back when we were talking about that because he reminded him of his daughter reaching out for him, he and his wife walking.
Exactly. I was just walking and I thought of it.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it looks like. Anyway, so it's the harvest of standing grain. And his protective shepherd, his Zeruah, will reap the harvest of first fruits. All right. Zeruah is a word that, early, I've had Zeruah, the sacrificial lamb, and that's how it's defined in the Torah for the most part, and said, this is great, this is Yosha. And Yosha is the sacrificial lamb. If you put all of prophecy together, there are three Zeruah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the most important prophecy regarding Yosha is Yeshaya 53. But nobody wants to start Yeshaya 53 in the beginning, which says two things that are just stunningly remarkable. One of them is, who has figured out who the Zeruah are? Because the key to this whole prophecy I'm about ready to share with you about the Passover lamb is figuring out who are the Zeruah. And the next thing it says is, this Passover lamb, he's got nothing. Don't worship him. There's absolutely nothing about him that should cause you to focus on him. He's the Passover lamb, for crying out loud.
Don't create
a religion on this whole Passover lamb. Don't anoint the Passover lamb as the Messiah. Don't anoint the Passover lamb as the Son of God. I'm not killing my son. We went through that before with Yishak. No, no, no. Don't kill your son. And so the most important prophecy of presenting Yosha as the Passover lamb begins with, this is Yashaya saying, who's figured out who the Zeruah are? Well, we did. The answer to that question. And there's three of them.
Moshe.
And it is. Yahweh tells us who the three are. The first, Zeruah, Moshe. He was the strong arm of God that led the chosen people out of bondage and Mitzrayim and the crucibles of human oppression to the promised land. He was a strong and upstanding shepherd, tending to the flock. He's a Zeruah. The second Zeruah is the Son of God, the Messiah, the King of Kings, Dod. And the third Zeruah is Yosha. Now, so when he says that his protective shepherd will reap the harvest, his Zeruah could be any one of those three people. He has three Zeruah. So it's incumbent upon us to figure out which one it is, because it's singular. Not all three.
Still.
It's one of them. Passover lamb doesn't come back to life, does it?
No.
That's not the purpose of the Passover lamb. Moshe wasn't even allowed into the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
Moshe's job was to shepherd the people to the promised land.
Got him to the door. Yep.
Get him to the door.
Okay.
That was his job. And he did it marvelously. That guy, he had a rough start. I know the feeling. But boy, did he finish well. Man. And he took the job seriously. He really did. He was, you listen to some of his talks in the body. He had it figured out. He was a smart guy. He understood. He took that job seriously. He's a hard guy not to love, and you can empathize with him. But he wouldn't even allow him to pass over land. God's not bringing him back and welching on the deal that he made.
Yeah, and you want a shepherd.
And by the fact, when I was translating, I believe it was Yashaya 51 for the that chapter on Eden. Remember how all this time I've said that I can't prove it, but I think that in Yirmiyah 31, when Yah was writing the Torah inside of us, that it's a lowercase T. It's not the existing Torah. It's teaching and guidance.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to tell us how to operate our lives and have the most fun.
For the future.
In the future when we're seven-dimensional, so we don't screw things up and we maximize our fun and growth, and that it's a lowercase T, and it's teaching that's applicable to our new life together. In Yashaya 51, Yahweh introduces, and it's last days. This is the earth's been returned to the conditions found in the Garden of Eden. And Yahweh says, right then and immediately and forcefully, from me will come a Torah. The way he said it, it cannot be the Torah that he gave to Moses.
No,
this is something
no, it's already
new,
there.
It's profound, it's energetic. Wow. And in the moment I'm returning the earth to the conditions of the Garden of Eden, this is what I'm bringing. And by the way, this Torah teaching, guidance, will be specifically designed to enable you to exercise good judgment and to think and make good decisions.
You'll always have free will.
It proves, I think, anyway, I'm natural. I guess I have to be careful on some of this stuff because it just seems so obvious to me that I'll share it and write about it. I said, this is what he's talking about. And then I see it affirmed, and I'm saying, okay, well, that's exactly what I thought was the case, and there it is. But it certainly seems to make that unequivocal, that we're going to get a new Torah. not the the old Torah put inside of us. That there'll be nothing about it that'll be inconsistent with the existing Torah. We're still going to celebrate the seventh mm-hmm. feast. We're still going to honor the Shabbat mm-hmm. Intent. But what we're going to be given is going to be appropriate for the world that we're going to be living in. So his perfective shepherd, so it's not Moshe, and it certainly can't be the Passover lamb. Passover lamb is one and done.
He was a lamb, not a shepherd. Yeah.
Right. And last time I checked, Yahweh not only declared specifically that Dod was his Zeruah, he also said to Dod specifically and only to Dod, "You are my shepherd. You are going to shepherd my people." The only person that Yahweh has said specifically is coming back. And coming back with him is Dod. So, and the protective shepherd who will reap the harvest ain't Jesus, no matter how pretty they dress him up, no how big the halo is, how white the robes, how pretty the little sandals and the feet. No. Isn't going to be Jesus of Nazareth, didn't exist. So, protective shepherd is going to reap this harvest of first fruits. We're going to get to meet Dod at that time. And, of course, it's a harvest of first fruits because he's harvesting covenant children. Then he says, "Then it shall be as one would conduct a gleaning." A gleaning is a rapid gathering up of what is left, quickly removing all or most of the remaining harvest, speaking of a numerically insignificant ingathering, implying that a very small amount is being collected in relation to the energy that is being expended to withdraw that harvest of first fruits in the broad valley of Rephaim. Yahweh's been pretty explicit all the way through that he's not in the numbers, quality, not quantity. And in the second statement, he etched in stone, he says that thousands will benefit from his mercy by observing the terms and conditions of the covenant. Thousands amongst billions is one in a million. There'll be 7 billion people, 8 billion people on the planet I would think that we'll still have 7 or 8 billion. I don't think we'll enter the death zone and probably until slightly after this. So there could be that many people on the planet, 7, 8 billion people. We're talking about
at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, maximum. 7, 8,000 maximum. And quite frankly, unless, I think that thanks to everyone who has made this, devoted themselves to their rewrites of these of the Yada Yahweh series, and the edits of them, contributed to them, and their the way they are presented now in terms of their covers, and also the way that they're presented so much just so beautifully inside with the way they're paginated and the fonts and the like is so much more readable, and the content. I think the content is a hundredfold better than it previously was. That so there is a and we're continuing to work at it. We're going to have a marvelous library out there for people to come to know Yahweh. If you want to know him, he's eminently knowable, lovable, likable, approachable, and so we're hoping that the harvest is huge. But I think. Reasonably, we could be looking at 7,000 people. That's what we could be looking at. So mm-hmm. It will be like a gleaning. So God's saying it's not going to be a lot of people. In fact, the world is not going to pay much attention to it. Of first fruits in the broad valley of Rephaim. Rephaim is the dead and departed without material substance, the souls of the deceased along the broad and open way. You know, I've talked about there's a reason that the world has a fascination with zombies
mm-hmm.
because most people are the walking dead. They're headed to their own demise. They can't think their way out of a wet paper bag. They're zombies. And so God is saying that Raphaim are zombies, and they brought an open way of religion and conspiracy, really. And so it's out of this that Yahweh is extracting his covenant family. That, my friends, is Teruah. That is what Teruah is all about. Although I think that the so far will sound sweeter on Teruah, but that indeed is what
it's called for.
When it happened on this day, shofar is going to be blown, and it's going to be Dod, the great shepherd, who's going to bring the flock home.
Wow,
kind of cool. I mean, I have never really had any interest. Maybe this is weird, but really, since I began this, I've not had any interest in meeting the Passover Lamb. I don't even know if we'll ever. I don't know if Passover Lamb even exists anymore, because I think the soul of the Passover Lamb that was Yahweh's soul. So I don't even think there is such a thing. But it's never been interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
His disciples, not really interesting to me. I've always wanted to meet Dod, and I've always wanted to meet Eliyah. I think those guys are really interesting. And over time, Moshe has gotten to be more and more endearing as a character as well. I think Samuel will be a fascinating guy. I think Yashiah will be a fascinating guy to meet.
Well,
the ultimate hero of the story, the most interesting man who ever lived, is Dod, and it's Dod that's going to be gathering us. So, a marvelous experience. And in him, there will be a remnant. There will be a remnant who will be spirit and survive. There will be a physical beings who will remain and who will be left behind, but also a remnant of souls who will leave and live because they are related in a close family relationship. These words are really loaded with meaning. Gleaning, as in the going round at the right time of year. Now, the right time of year for this harvest? Teruah.
Right now.
Of what? An olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top, uppermost branch. The highest branch. That would be the branch of Dod.
Mm-hmm.
Four or five on its fruitful branches, which have been cut away, clinging to a crevice of its, the olive's flourishing and productive limbs, those who live life abundantly and produce offspring in successive generations, prophetically declares Yahweh, the God of the Roman Catholic Church. No, I didn't say that. The God of Jerry Falwell Jr., which is, you bring in the cash, you get to keep your job, no matter how bad a scoundrel you are. No, I don't think that's it either. The God of Yisrael. That's really tough for Christians and for Jews, both, because for Christians they want this replacement theology. But if he's announcing in the last days of this Teruah harvest, that he's the God of Yisrael and not the God of the church, if you were a Christian, you screwed, blued, and tattooed. You goofed. And, of course, if you're a rabbi and you're into the Judaism, well, whatever happened to Israel? Now, most rabbis aren't into Israel. They're into Jews, which is the tribe of Yehuda. They're not into Israel. Not their thing. He's the God of Israel. So, in this regard, you know, the olives are obviously telling. They're nourishing, sharing Yah's word, or they rot at the tree. When pressed, they can produce pure and brilliant, smoke-free light, enlightening the observant. But while this ability is latent, the benefits only occur by design with a vessel, a wick and a spark, the covenant and the word, along with the set apart spirit. The Olila, translated gleanings, we have a couple of subtle insights there too to ponder regarding the illuminating and nourishing olives who are being spared at this time. The first is that these entail the remnant of the covenant that was deliberately left on this tree of life, attached to its branches, rooted as part of Yisrael by Yahweh to convey his message to those who were looking in the right direction. You know, God doesn't want to remove witnesses until not removing them would be hazardous to his family. So we get to stay as witnesses for as long as staying as possible. The second is, since Olah is shaded by Alal, we have yet another distinction between the harvestable olives and those destined to fall down on their own, die, and rot away. The productive olives will be revealing the foolishness of wanton, abusive, and ruthless religious rites, pointing out their ignorance and hypocrisy, exposing that which few are aware through investigation and reason. Then you go to the phrase ka knockoff, as in going around at the right time of year. It points us right back to the fifth Moed Mikre, Teruah.
Yes.
It's actually the second of three harvests that are included with the Moed. First day of the seventh month, it's today, this year. We have to wonder, Shamaim meaning two, and then it's two or three. And then the other speaks of three or four, two or three, three or four. Who is it that God is specifically speaking of? How does it equate to the number of people who are likely to be harvested? Where are they going to come from? And so the uppermost branch, two or three, let's say it's three, that represent 3,000. The uppermost branch has got to be Yehuda, Jews.
Yes.
You know, the larger figure of 3 to 4, making, you know, 3 plus 4, 7 total. The larger figure is likely Gentiles. In fact, the terminology speaks of being grafted. So these are covenant children that were adopted into the family. So whether it's 2 plus 5 is 7 or 3 plus 4 is 7 between the naturally born and the adopted, it's likely going to be 7,000 people that leave the earth at this time. And I think that 3,000 of them are likely to be Yehudim and 4,000 were likely to be Goyim. And I read something interesting the other day, speaking of Yehudim and Goyim. You know, I'm in both Sioux Indian, and that ethnicity traces through actually Russia, which is where the Native Americans came from, and Irish. And so they were doing a long history DNA search of the Irish. And guess where our DNA originates? Middle East.
Middle East.
Middle East.
Yeah.
We're Shemites.
And Celtic.
We're Shemites. How in the world? No, actually, they had issue with the ties to the Celtics. They said that the Irish actually preceded them, and yet the Irish DNA shows that the people that are genuinely Irish came from the Middle East. They didn't want to say Israel, but That was certainly the implication.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
well, it all started
been,
there.
They've been in Ireland so long that, you know, they consider themselves, the DNA points to Ireland. But when you look deep into that DNA, it traces all the way back to Israel. So we're kind of, if that report, that academic paper is correct, we would be closet Jews.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Yeah, so that works. So,
oh, darn.
At the end, there will be, yeah, two or three ripe olives at the top of the uppermost branch, four or five, if it's fruitful, which are separated and cut away, prophetically declares Yahweh, the God of Israel, of those who engage and endure with God. That is a marvelous way to present the Teruah. Focused on our time, the events that will lead up to the harvest, giving us the timing of the harvest. And when we turn to Yeshayah 18, of course, the thing we immediately encounter is that we're confronted by the woe. We are confronted by war and Muslims flooding into to Israel. So it's, you know, highly likely that that right after we're out of here, that you're going to have, I actually called the chapter, the end of religion, because you know, it opens. In that specific day, you know, this man will, this is the continuation of Yeshayah 7, it's 17. It says, in that specific day, this man will actually gaze upon and genuinely regard and actually accept the Almighty, the one who engaged and acted to get this done, his maker. So if you're one of, and I would assume that that most everyone listening to this program is going to be part of that true harvest. As part of that harvest, each one of us will have the opportunity to actually gaze upon Almighty God. That while Dod may be the shepherd, his shepherd is Yahweh, and we're going to have the opportunity to get to know our Maker, the one who got this done on our behalf. It'll be an amazing experience. You know, it's hard to even fathom. We celebrate his words. We celebrate his mikra and mikre. We celebrate the covenant. We celebrate his prophecies. We celebrate our relationship with him and with one another. And life is fulfilling and it's wonderful. But I mean, just imagine. You know, you've been taken out of all of the corruption of the corona nonsense and the Black Lives Matter nonsense and the political nonsense and the conspiracy nonsense and all of the wars and anti-Semitic nonsense and everything we have learned and come to know is all of a sudden brilliant and materialized right in our presence. You know, you don't know if your first reaction is going to be, oh, thank God, I'm here, I can relax now. Job's over. It's party time. Oh, my God. I would have taken like a 6,000-year nap. Wake me. Wake me when it's over. Or, you know,
thank you.
Oh,
going to be
God.
Energized. It's going to be too much fun.
Yeah, you know, part of it is going to be that the guy that finishes the marathon and then sees, you know, all of the accolades, and he just wants to lay down and take a nap. So I think that part of it will be that. And the other part of it is going to be you're going to be so overstimulated and so energized that you're going to say, thank God that I'm now seven-dimensional because this is a lot of stimulation.
Yeah.
And then part of it is just going to be the genuine joy of looking around. I had a long conversation with my youngest son tonight. And my ex, his mother, I can't even call her his mother because she's a monster. has been so hurtful and harmful to him. And the idea of being able to turn to him and say, it's all over. You're here now. He can't bother you anymore. You're here, and God loves you. You know, what a thrill it's going to be for us to find one another on that day and give each other a hug and then look around and see how many others are there because of the devotion we really had to sharing Yahweh's testimony. I just think it's so many things are going to be happening at once, and you're going to want to go off and explore, and you're also going to say, you know, a nap seems like a good idea right about now. Some time, we'll explore a little later.
Yeah. How do you think Yeshayahu is going to feel? I mean, after he's experienced to open the doors and nobody came, and all of a sudden, wow.
You know, no, I think as I read Yeshayahu and I read the 11th chapter on the Choder, and then I read chapter 29, where he is witnessing what happens in the end and the role that his words play. And then, yeah, you read Yeshayahu 17 and seeing what's happening with Israel. He knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we told him. Yeah, he knows. His eyes will choose to continually look towards God, the set-apart one of Yisrael. So initially we're going to be kind of starstruck is what it says. And then he shall never accept nor gaze upon the altars, the works of the hands representing what fingers have made, not focus upon either that which is associated with the Asherahs, the mothers of God, the queens of heaven, and the Madonnas with child, or the worship of sun god images. Knows. The religion based upon Asherah, which is Easter, Sunday, mm-hmm. The mother of God, the queen of heaven, the Madonna and child, is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
The religion of sun god images is Christianity and Judaism. And so what he's saying is, that's all gone. There's no more religions. Nothing distracting at all about religion, religious imagery. We no longer see the things that man has made to distract attention away from God. We're just going to focus on God. He's the real deal, and he is there present in front of us, and he is welcoming us into his presence. In that specific day, so he's just talking about, this is the experience that Yeshayahu witnessed. He has seen this day in advance, and Yeshayahu is just telling us what he saw, what happened. And so he's reporting that those of us who are there are going to be just dazzled by Yahweh and just so glad that all of that gunk is gone. All of the protests, all of the politics, all of the militarism, all of the disease, all of the conspiracy, all of the religion.
All the politicians and preachers, God, go
no,
away.
All gone. And that specific day it shall come to be that the cities of his refuge and his defensive fortifications shall be abandoned and deserted, consistent with an occult presence among the religious and the merchants of death. Man's religious edifices will be gone. God's going to both eliminate all traces of religion in terms of the buildings, the Bibles, the scriptures, the Qurans, the Books of Mormon, the Zohars, they're all gone. But so are all those buildings. There'll be no more religious edifices, no more political edifices, no more military bases. All of it's gone. All of the military fortifications, all deserted. There's no longer a merchant of death. And then the uppermost branch, the olive, therefore, will be completely deserted for a time because of the presence of the children of Yisrael. Then there will be appalling desolation and stupefying ruin. It's going to happen very quickly, but after the Teruah harvest, we're going to see a devastation of man's military might, those who have come against Israel, and it will be devastating. And the earth is going to go to war. Man's going to fight one another. It's going to be natural disasters of even worse. I mean, we're watching. We had eight hurricanes or eight tropical storms, named storms, brewing up in the Atlantic at one time. And we've had storm after storm now devastate the Gulf Coast of the United States. And there is a med cyclone right now slashing Greece. We've had, four of the five worst fires in California history all blazing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Black Lives Matter destroying our cities. You've got a pandemic that who knows what the numbers are. I mean, it's just so convoluted on this disease. But you've got world leaders depriving people of their lives and livelihoods, or their freedoms and livelihoods. And it's going to get so much worse. So appalling destruction, devastating ruin. This is the clearly now into the last 3.5 years. This is the worst time of the time of Jacob's trumpets. Indeed, because you have completely ignored and actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of the God of your salvation and deliverance and the rock and protection of your refuge, you do not remember nor mention. So the people that are left are going to be universally either ignorant of God or opposed to God. They will be religious. They will be political. They will be conspiratorial. They'll be militaristic. They'll be patriotic. They're going to be everything but covenant. There won't be a single covenant member in the world.
How tragic.
And so God says just death and destruction and total devastation. And it's because all of it is because you're totally ignorant of the God of your salvation and deliverance. You don't remember him. Therefore, you plant, embed, and erect vines and dwellings of Adonis, of the Lord, of Adonai.
Adonai, yes.
And you continually sow it as an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means of estrangement, be a vine or branch that needs to be pruned. God's going to allow this to happen there for a while because a lot of pruning needs to take place. God's not going to fill heaven with religious scum. And so there'll be a lot of pruning. And it's important that we know that. He's not uprooting the vine. Just pruning. Because that vine is Yisrael, and there will be a remnant of Yisrael that will be spared, and that remnant will be healthy. All of the unproductive trindles will be cut off. But this is the last 3 years of the time of Jacob's trouble. This is an exceedingly troubling time. You don't want to be here at that time. In that day, you will grow and then carefully construct a barrier around the garden of your garden. And in the early part of the day, when such things are considered, your seed will sprout, sending out shoots, which will be heaped up and held on the wrong side of the barrier for having wavered and wandered away from the harvest. In the daytime, there will be terminal disease and hopelessness, infirmity, weakness, affliction, and tribulation, including the influence of incurable and mortal and mental anguish. You've been forewarned. Now, God is speaking here to Israel. to the chosen people. You've been forewarned. You may have 7 or 8, maybe as many of you, even as 10, quasi-normalized years left. It's a death spiral, Ryan. It's going to get continually worse. But that's all you have. These last 3 years between 2030 and 2033, it's just going to be devastating. It's no matter what you do, it's going to die. You know, you're going to try to grow crops, and it's going to sprout up and then be scorched, be blown away, be burnt up. There's so many disasters that are occurring all of the time. Terminal diseases, pandemics, you know, raging fires, exceedingly strong storms, earthquakes, you name it. That says no matter how hard you work, what you do won't last the day. You know, you're not the solution, man. No matter how proud you may be, Israel, you can't save yourself. Whoa, be wary of the preponderance of people of a great many nations who will roar in as agitated hordes of confused terrorists, similar to loudly groaning, stormy and enraged seas, which are Gentiles. They will choose to be constantly infuriated and uproarious, continually snarling and angry, driven by winds of religious, political, and societal desire. And then the corrupting roar of the destructive societal chaos of the people of these nations who are transformed while massing under an antiquated and unifying religious and political leader will be like the horrible and destructive, desolating uproar of a flood. Forcefully and in great numbers, capitulating to the will of another, Allahu Akbar, they will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while creating an uproar. Magog war, the war that's been labeled Armageddon from Har, the hill of Megiddo. This is man fighting man to the end of man. This is the world disintegrating. This is the sum total of what we have become. The deadliest belief system in the history of humanity is social or secular humanism. It's second only to it barely beats Islam, which barely beats Christianity. And they will all be together and destructive and deadly, and they will all come against Israel, and it's going to be devastating. The numbers are likely that in Israel that it will be millions of jihadists, and there won't be enough bullets to stop them. They're going to flood in. It's like any kind of flood. You see the pictures of what happened when Sally hit the Alabama, Florida coast on the panhandle, and devastating. You can't stop it. Israel won't be able to stop this flood of jihadists. And so it's going to be, and the world's going to see it. You know, right now, because of smartphones and the like, everyone's going to see it and experience it at the same time. And so it's literally like you're going to have video of these words haunting your computer and your phone. My guess is that 9 out of 10 people are going to die. And it's going to be from all causes, environmental, war, pestilence, a pandemic, of course, an asteroid impact, likely even end in nuclear confrontation. God specifically says that unless he were to intervene, life itself would be destroyed. He's promised that Israel is going to exist. He's going to spare Israel. And as bad as it gets with the planet devastated by an asteroid, devastated by earthquakes, devastated by climate events, devastated by world war, devastated by nuclear attacks, devastated by pandemics. That says, not to worry. I'm going to recreate Eden. We're going to go back to where it all began. I'm going to take my family there. I'm going to camp out for a while. It's going to be great fun. Such is the story of Teruah. That's what we're celebrating tonight. It is a time of great joy where we get to share the God we've come to know and love, cherish his words and share the words that we've come to know and love, to offer others the invitation to these seven annual celebrations with Yahweh, to share what we know about the covenant, how to participate in it, to understand what God is offering and expects in return, to share Yahweh's name, to share Yahweh's devotion to his people, while at the same token sharing Yahweh's hatred of religion, politics, and government, and militarism, and conspiracy. That man's way is the way of death, and Yahweh's way is the way of life, and so few people are going to find it, but yet for every single person in this world, the opportunity is yours. There may only be 7,000 people to capitalize. But if 7,001 wanted in, it would be so. Everybody can. It's just that most people don't want to. No interest in it. So it is a passion for us, the ultimate love affair. And we celebrate that love for Yahweh and Teruah. And, of course, what follows Teruah?
Yom Kippur.
Right. So what are we blowing the shofar for? To reconcile Yahweh and his chosen people. That is what the shofar is. It is calling Yehudim and Yisrael back into the covenant relationship, back home with Yahweh. And that is our job. That is our mission. That is our opportunity. And once the relationship is reconciled, what do? We camp out in the promised land, with the earth returning to the conditions of Eden. And we celebrate Shabbat for 1,000 years. One of the things I learned as I was retranslating everything for the Shabbat chapter of Yada Yahweh, the first volume, is that there is no indication in the Bereshit account of resting. That Shabbat is used as a verb. And so it's God celebrating the Shabbat, God observing the Shabbat. Making the Shabbat all it was intended to be, which is the celebrating the promise of seven. And so, there's no indication that there was idleness. Oh, it was the Shabbat is a celebration. And it was
why would you not party? why would it be
right,
sleeping?
Right,
you got all the energy in the world and you want to play. Let's go.
Yeah. Wouldn't you want to?
Fun.
Yeah. You've been energized and you've been enlightened, and now you have the freedom to go anywhere.
So why stagnate?
Yes. Yeah. I might take a little rest first. But
you're older. You're getting older.
But I'm older, I'm older. So, then we'll go. But oh my goodness. It's going to be just as the Shabbat is a celebration of life. Was looking back at all that had happened over those 14 billion years and was just enjoying the moment. And the Shabbat will be an eternal time of us together enjoying all that has happened, all that's going to happen, to have wonderful conversations. And Jews have actually made, religious Jews, the Shabbat the most difficult day of the week. There's so many rules of what you can't do that it's work. They've turned the Shabbat into work because there's a list of 1,000 things you can't do. It's work not doing those 1,000 things. That wasn't Yahweh's intent at all. So here's the day that we celebrate. I look forward to celebrating Yom Kippur. We'll return to Yeshaya 29, which is such a marvelous look at the last days in our relationship with Yahweh and Yahweh's relationship with his people when we return this time next week. Yah bless you all. Good night.
Good night.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom, yes.
Very. Very, very.
And when we get to inside the arsenal, and I'm going to be just like my God when it's taken out. After that, this was the best Yada Yada program ever.